It's a bright new day, and I want you to come look at a shining sun. Is it always raining at your side? I'll bet you're having fun. We'll be crying out loud, laughing and shout. I hope you want to see your smile. We'll be crying out loud, laughing and shout. Our love will never run out.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at stopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about 1 hour. And this week, our good movie is the 2003 South Korean romantic comedy Please Teach Me English. And our bad movie is the infamous 1974 science fiction flop Zardoz, directed by John Borman, Deliverance fame. But we will be starting with Please Teach Me English first. So this has kind of been on my radar for a really long time. It's on like my short list of South Korean comedies that I had heard good things about. And you know, you learn so much about foreign cultures watching foreign movies. And in South Korea's case, it's jarring in the way that like Japanese movies can be sometimes, except maybe not. I feel like South Korea is almost more westernized than Japan is at this point. But you learn about their weird social norms. You really learn about those watching their romantic comedies, which of course are about relationships between men and women. But it's like, I feel like this one is, in a way, it's kind of the weirdest South Korean movie we've seen so far. And in a way, it's also the most traditional, like from a romantic comedy standpoint. Almost. But like, you know, we watched Asako and Ruby Shoes before on your recommendation. And, excuse me, that was really cool. And that, you know, I noticed the main character in that movie was also a civil servant, just like the lead girl of Please Teach Me English. And in Asako and Ruby Shoes, like a guy basically has a crush on an internet porn webcam girl. And that's pretty odd. Zero and Conduct, which was just a couple episodes ago, like that one had like, you know, a tough guy wanting to get with a nerdy girl, and so he enlists the help of a nerdy guy to like, you know, get closer to her. And that's kind of a that's kind of a familiar setup, except like the way that it depicted the high school pecking order is kind of being like competition between a lot of youth gangs, but like accepting that as normal for there just to like be a lot of gangs running around the school, like not selling drugs, but like selling, I don't know, pornography, homemade pornography, things like that. That was kind of interesting. Please Teach Me English. It's like, well, number one, there's this kind of like animated prologue where you hear the main girl saying like, man, why is it the Koreans can't ever compliment each other on anything? And she's kind of like lamenting what it's like to be a woman in Korea. And she feels really bad that she doesn't know English. And I mean, as the title kind of implies, that's sort of what the movie is about. Like she wants to or she gets picked to be the person at the office who has to learn English because nobody else does. She goes to this English class. She has a crush on this kind of bad boy, cocky, handsome guy who's like flirting with the teacher, and it seems like there's going to be kind of a romantic triangle between the three of them. And there is. But, you know, this being a South Korean movie, it's never just one plot. Like that kind of resolves, you know, by the end of the second act, and then the third act is almost like a different movie. Cause the third act is about how you find out that the guy, the handsome guy, he's only taking these English lessons to help his mom, reconnect with a daughter who's his sister and who they've never known because she had to give the daughter up for adoption and she was raised in America. So she only speaks English. And that's like what the third act is about. But then they turn that like into a wacky misunderstanding where the nerdy girl who's the main character, she thinks that this guy's sister is like an old girlfriend or something, and that's why he's learning English. So she tries to like sabotage the meeting by acting as the translator and kind of ruining it until, you know, she realizes what's up, and then everything works out. So it's sort of like the movie that Please Teach Me English is in the first couple of acts really struck me as like being it's not a romantic comedy that would be made here, not because anything about it is particularly offensive, but because it's about this nerdy girl who's supposed to be, you know, mousy and unattractive and stuff, and she's the main character, and it's about her like pining for this handsome guy who totally doesn't notice her because the English teacher in their class is hot. And it's not, the guy doesn't like reform. He doesn't like learn to see her inner beauty or anything. They just kind of like naturally hook up together when the guy realizes that, that he's not going to get with the cute, British white woman who teaches the class. And, it's written by a woman, which I didn't realize until after I watched it, but I looked it up on IMDb, and it was written by a woman. So like, you can't say that this isn't like from a woman's perspective. In a way, it's kind of like a nerdy girl's fantasy that, you know, just through persistence, it's almost like a male nerd's fantasy through persistence. You know, you can get the really cute girl. She'll see your inner beauty. That's like what this is, but with a girl main character. And the thing of it is, like with American romantic comedies, it's like they don't want the lead woman to be unattractive, you know. They don't want her, she can be a little goofy, she can be like a Sarah Jessica Parker type, you know, but like that's as eccentric as they're willing to make it. Please Teach Me English is really great because it's a romantic comedy about a nerdy girl, and you don't see that very much. And it's pretty affable and everything.
Yeah,
I found that kind of charming.
What's the guy version in American movies is what? Can't Buy Me Love. They turned nerdy Patrick Dempsey into the cool kid, and then
yeah,
she's but, all that.
Yeah, was the, she's all that.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the closest example to Please Teach Me English might be, and I haven't seen this movie. I'm going off of the trailers, but Never Been Kissed, where Drew Barrymore is supposed to be a former high school nerd, and then she goes back to high school to be popular and pretty this time, and that's not at all creepy. But
I think she's back. I think there's an actual story. I don't think it's like she's doing an amateur 21 Jump Street. Not to defend Never Been Kissed, but
well, anyways,
that'd be kind of cool, actually. Yeah. If there was an American movie starring Drew Barrymore as a creepy person who went back to high school to try, yeah, I mean that'd be kind of cool. But yeah, I mean, it's totally different.
Totally different. And I love watching South Korean movies. It's always a pleasant surprise in one way or another. It's never quite what you're expecting. It's usually something better.
Yeah. And I mean, this one was the first one I've seen where they had a lot of, it might be the first one I've seen where they had native English speakers.
Yeah, this movie has a lot of native English speaking going on. And I noticed a lot of it was unsubtitled. Like the reason that she goes to the English class in the first place is an early scene where an American guy comes into this government office and he's asking about his water bill or something. And nobody can answer him, and he's speaking English and everything, but there's no subtitles. I also think there aren't subtitles in all the scene in all the actual ESL classes where the British white woman is speaking in English. There's no subtitling going on there. It only happens a few times, like a couple of times, like later in the movie where they're both at the bar and the handsome guy is on a date with the English teacher and the nerdy girl just happens to be there and she just happens to run into the guy who came into the government office at the beginning of the movie. And I think there's subtitles in that scene. But there's a lot of English in the movie that is not subtitled for Koreans. So I would say we probably got a better – we had a more enjoyable experience watching this as native English speakers than even South Koreans would.
Going back to the weirdness of the romantic comedy thing, I mean, she's – there's this scene in the sequence in the movie where she's trying to get the guy sort of away for the weekend. And so she and the teacher come up with this idea that they'll go out to her grandparents' farm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where you have the protagonist lying to roughly 16 people about why they're going there. And stranding them there to spend time with this guy. And, I mean, it all works out for her there. But it's just, it's really interesting because it's not a...
It's kind of a weird turn. It's kind of the beginning of the last act of the movie because right after that, they get pretty heavily into the handsome guy meeting up with his sister.
Right, who unfortunately...
Oh, that's right. That's right, because on the bus ride back from the farm, she overhears him talking about...
the girl,
the sister, thinking that it's his
the
girlfriend.
The mistaken identity.
Yeah.
The sister, so yeah, I mean, that's kind of the thing. So she's in the, they go through why everyone's learning English, but they don't tell you why the handsome guy is learning English. And he's a shoe salesman at a department store.
Right.
And so when you first meet him.
And he lives with
he lives
the
with
mom.
His mom. when you first meet him, you're, there's the possibility he's a little bit more impressive than that, and then he's the shoe salesman in the department store. And, you know, we watched Mannequin for the podcast, and anytime there's a department store employee, I mean, there's somebody in the movie that reminds you of James Spader in Mannequin, and there is in this one, too. The schmarmy guy who won't sell her the red shoes.
Switcher!
So, yeah, you never find out in the classroom setting where everybody else is introducing their reasons for taking the class. You don't find out that he's there to learn how to speak English because he's going to meet his sister who was given up for adoption by the mother after the father ran out on them. She went to America, became a lawyer, and is coming back to meet her family. And there, it's suggested in one scene that he has told the teacher this, but since the movie, for the most part, is from the girl's perspective, and she's hostile to the teacher at this point, she doesn't really pay attention to that. But the sister shows up at the end, and it's, you know, this whole comedy of errors thing, except it's not really funny. I mean, it's like a tragedy of errors for a bit. I mean, it's just, it's painful.
Yeah, you kind of, you almost hate the main character.
Yeah, I mean, the main character does awful, awful things. And it's additionally problematic because the girl they got to play the sister from America
speaks really phonetic English.
Yeah. They did not apparently decide to hire a Korean actress, American or Korean actress, to go over and do it. They instead got the worst English speaking Korean actress they could find, and tried to pass her off as
that's the one instance where it's better
as a lawyer from New York.
better to be a Korean speaker for that scene.
I was just kind of sitting there going, "Good grief! This is horrendous!" Like. Did they just luck out with all the other, because the teacher, the girl who plays the teacher and the guy who plays the, I meant the teacher and the guy in the first scene who speaks English.
Yeah.
It's not like Japanese movies where they, in Japan, there's like a stock of English American actors who live over there and they appear in tons of movies and they suck. I mean, they're terrible. I mean, just watch any Godzilla movie made after 1992, and they've always got some lone American in there who you look him up, and he's been living in Japan for like 30 years, and he's in like 60 movies, and he's terrible in all of them.
Yeah.
I think they flew people over from Australia to act in this movie, and, you know, it worked out. And so then you got the sister, and she's just, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's bad, but I mean, the real disappointment by that point in the movie is that the last act, like, does become this cliched sitcom kind of situation, or cliched romantic comedy situation.
It's mean-spirited.
Yeah, and it's...
Which is interesting.
It's mean-spirited. It's uncomfortable to watch.
And then there's this, like, strange...
Because there's nobody to root against. Like, you want everybody to be happy, you know.
And then there's the weird ending with the sort of Crocodile Dundee on the subway thing. And it's... It's like it's from a different movie, almost. And that's kind of the thing that we saw this in Zero for Conduct. And it's similar in that the romance takes a while. Like the flirtation, it takes a while to become flirtation. In this, you have them. They go hang out one night in the middle of the night. And, I mean, that's another thing you were talking about, how you learn about the culture from a movie. I mean, you've got this civil servant who lives with her parents at 25, and they treat her dismissively until the one point where she's just like, you know what? I can just leave and take the money I pay you for rent with me, and they freak out at that. So, I mean,
yeah,
there's something there. And so, the civil servant, Elvis, the guy, that's their American name.
Yeah, they pick American names in the first class, and the handsome guy's nickname is Elvis.
And the girl's nickname is Candy.
Right.
And, you know, that's kind of the thing is that's what's so cool about it is the characters change throughout and they reveal themselves. Like, the English teacher, I thought she was a complete bitch because, I mean, she's so rude to the girl.
Right.
Until she has her, like, breakdown, and then the girl talks to her and stuff like that. And
she has a scene where she's like, oh, you people don't care about this at all. You know, I'm trying my best here. And, yeah, suddenly she's not such a bitch anymore.
Yeah. And so it's Elvis and Candy. And what scene was I lost the scene.
What, in the bar with the four of them? Elvis and Candy and the American guy in the beginning.
That was an interesting scene, too, because I thought it was creepy.
Creepy that she followed him, yeah.
No, not even that. I was like, concerned about the American guy or the Australian guy. I'm like, yeah, it could turn. It's a Korean movie. It could turn at any moment.
Right. You never know.
At any moment, it could just... Well, we didn't talk about the opening. The video game opening.
Oh, well, that's kind of a whole other thing. I mean, not only is the are the opening titles animated, I mean, there's a lot of movies that do that, but this movie makes pretty extensive use of CG special effects to humorous effect, much the way that Zero and Conduct had, like, special effects enhanced fight sequences to make them funnier. And I've seen that in other Korean movies, and I think they're just more willing to, like, they have faith in their audience that if you have something outlandish happen and it's funny, that it's not going to, like, it's not taking people out of the movie.
Right.
Just to make a joke that needs a special effect to go with it, like a video. Right, they do like a brief fighting video game parody scene where, you know, these first time English speakers are trying their best against their opponents and trying to speak English and they're not doing good, and so they're getting their asses kicked in this video game. So scenes like that, yeah. I mean, and to be in a, you know, romantic. I mean, is this a woman's film? Is this a women's film? I mean, it seems so accessible. I mean, on so many levels, like, because the main character is this nerdy girl, but I mean, there's a little something for everybody. And also, like, with you know, the fact that they have special effects jokes and that they have a video game parody sequence and stuff. I mean, this movie came out in like 2003, I think I said. So like, yeah. You know, what's the big deal about Scott Pilgrim doing it now?
Exactly. That's what I was thinking about. And I think that's,
That's not a bold, brilliant new idea. They were doing this in Korea 10 years ago.
And the thing is that the audience is willing to accept it as a storytelling technique.
Yeah.
As opposed to here, where clearly they're not, and it instead becomes fetishized as a hipster, contrarian thing. Whereas here, I mean, like, yeah, it was jarring at first, but and then it got really funny.
It's all just a joke in the context of the story. Yeah.
And I wasn't expected to know that it was a scene from Super Mario Brothers 4 or something.
Yeah, you know? they're not expecting you to know specifically which fighting video game that they're parodying.
Yeah.
It's just the idea of one.
And then that goes away, which is interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, they sort of do a lot of things only once. Like, there is only one video game fight scene, but there's also like a scene where I think it's after the first night of the class, and the girl and the guy are at the bus stop together, and she's trying to start a conversation, and he's not interested, and she says something embarrassing, and like she hangs her head, and then suddenly like they superimpose an embarrassed drawing of her cartoon face from the opening titles, looking really embarrassed, and it just kind of like, you know, superimposes over her face for a few seconds and then fades away. And they don't do anything like that in the whole rest of the movie. It's just that one scene in that one moment, and that it sort of feels so liberating to know that they're willing to do that. It really makes you feel like, okay, they're not restricting themselves. If they think it's a good idea for the scene, they're not like worried about if it all matches the aesthetics and whatnot. Sort of just like, as long as it's all in the same tone, you can do whatever you want with the special effects. I guess one of the more, like, I don't know, pedestrian examples of a CG-enhanced scene that isn't so, you know, comic book or video game inspired is early in the movie, she hasn't taken the class yet, and she's wondering, oh, should I do it? And she's starting to have like an anxiety attack about not knowing English. So there's a scene where she's on the bus and she's looking out the window, and like, I went to Japan one time, and if Korea is anything like Japan, I mean, they do have lots and lots of print signs and advertising and stuff with English words and phrases in them. So she's like on the bus and watching all these English words on billboards and stuff kind of fly by, and as they fly by, they start to float in front of her and cluster into a big mass, and you know, it's that's a simple use of, you know, using the technology that you have to create a scene, but it's just purely creative and uninhibited.
Yeah, and that always, I mean, it's completely different, but it reminds me of Hollywood movies in the 30s.
How so?
Where they were, my big example is, I think, it's a Michael Curtiz movie. One of the Philo Vance ones, where they're explaining how the, you know, guy shot from the other building, and so they show you the buildings with a line going across it, and maybe even like the roof coming off of a building. And I know The Bat from 30 has something like that, where they were really willing to, they weren't so concerned with the aesthetic being all real. They were willing to break the fourth wall or whatever that, you know.
Yeah, they weren't afraid to break. They weren't afraid to break the fourth wall, and they weren't afraid to be unrealistic, even if they were telling a realistic. They weren't afraid to have the filmmaking techniques like step out of the bounds of reality, even if, you know, as long as the story was set in reality.
And in a lot of ways, that creates a movie. It utilizes what you can do with it a lot more.
Yeah. It's like total filmmaking, as Jerry Lewis would say. You know, this isn't – I have an example, too. It's probably not as good of a one because it is like a broad, slapsticky comedy. But remember in Duck Soup when Harpo Marx shows his tattoo of a doghouse on his chest and then a live-action dog pops out of it?
Yeah. I mean, it's exactly like that. I mean, you're – yeah, it's being willing to do that kind of thing. And
yeah, this movie's got it, and so have some of the other South Korean movies we've seen separately and on our own. So
yeah.
It's cool. It's cool. Another Korean culture joke that I liked was also about the main character being a civil servant. There's a scene where I think it's right after the scene I was just talking about, like Elvis leaves to go somewhere, and oh, he's going to meet up with the English teacher. They're going to a bar or something, and she's following them surreptitiously. And so she steps onto a bus and she says, driver, follow that car. And he's like, what are you, crazy? I'm a bus driver. And she takes out her civil servant ID badge and she's like, I'm a civil servant. And he's like, oh, shit, hold on. And does like she says. So sure, you got to be Korean to get these civil service jokes, but they stick out pretty broadly.
Yeah, I mean, that was and it creates this hilarious – I mean, it's unbelievable or whatever, but, I mean, it's a great sequence of this the visual of the bus doing this thing is just hilarious.
Yeah. So let's see here.
But it's also the whole – the thing with the teacher – it has end credit. Over the end credits, you get some more stuff of where the characters are. And that's the other thing is it's kind of a really pat conclusion for the two leads in a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately. But yeah, so you find out the two people in the class were married and nobody ever talked about it during the entire movie. But then you also discover that the teacher runs off with a
a Korean gentleman.
Yeah.
Oh wait, she runs off with an older. Oh wait, no,
yeah.
the older fella in the class gets a young white woman, but the teacher also runs off with a young Korean, right?
No, that is the teacher.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, the pizza scene, yeah. And so it's this really, you know, this one of the scenes that really humanized her turns out to be this really cute conclusion, weird conclusion. And I mean, it's just totally, you never would have that in an American movie because you can't have the cute teacher run off with some, you know, Billy Bob. Well, I guess you can, but
he's not that creepy. He's just some old salaryman.
Well,
oh,
he's
the other man. Oh, the other way. Sorry, what were you saying?
That's the pizza delivery man. He quits his job to become a pizza delivery man.
Another way that the last act of this movie is cliched in American romantic comedy terms is that it ends with Elvis following Candy through a subway car and then like proposing to her in front of the subway car. And it's that scene from every romantic comedy where he's like in front of her and everybody on the subway car is listening and they're like, tell her that you love her. So
yeah,
the ending is really the only disappointing thing about the movie. So kind of the last section of the movie. Let's see here. Oh, another kind of fantasy sequence that I really enjoyed in the movie was where she imagines. I mean, this is kind of a little more traditional because like it's a dream sequence, but it's not CG enhanced. It's just different. She imagines that like a SWAT team busts into the class and it's all you know, choppers and black suited SWAT guys with jack boots, and they're like, "We're going to execute all of you unless you can speak good English." And she almost makes it, but it doesn't quite work. And that's just funny. What else? Oh, when she follows Elvis and the English teacher, she like freaks out at one point, sticks her head into a bucket of water, and she imagines that she's like a sort of It's like her, a photo of her face is on a paper cutout body that's swimming through the water and getting attacked by an octopus. That's another fantasy sequence. But, I mean, you know, all these, like I said, all these fantasy sequences attempt to do it a little bit differently each time. Yeah, you just get the sense that it's like these people really like making movies and they're bursting with imagination. Let's see. What else did you like about it?
I like the Elvis and the mom. I thought it got bumpy at times, but it was really interesting. I mean, none of the characters are particularly unlikable, but none of them are particularly likable either, which is really funny as a way for them to do it. The mother's not perfect. The Elvis is far from perfect. I mean, another problem with the ending is it seems
they kind like of reform Elvis.
Well, they reform him, but there's like a joke that they don't have set up. Because it ends with, we haven't completely spoiled it yet, but anyway. So it ends with them having a baby, and for some reason she gives him a look about how he wasn't going to go get the diapers.
Oh yeah, I didn't get that.
Yeah, and it's just this weird joke, and it wasn't set up at all.
Maybe it's a cultural thing.
Okay.
And diapers and such. I think the way Elvis just kind of reforms and ends up married to her and with child is just kind of that's one of the small clues that this is like a women's picture and that it was written by a woman, because if you just hang around a bad boy enough, your goodness will rub off on him.
Yeah, and I mean, he does eventually. Yeah, he does, I guess, reform. Well, I mean, that's the other thing, is his reforming is somewhat independent of her, too. It's not because of her so much as because his mother's really upset at the idea that he's turning out to be a son of a bitch like his dad.
Yeah, which she says, which kind of puts some emotional gravity into that aspect of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Not so much her. Did you notice when the main character is watching CNN to learn English, like the graphic on the TV says like war in somewhere or like war somewhere.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
That was good. Yeah. Cause she's showing off to her parents that she can watch CNN.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was good.
And the Korean composite of a CNN headline is war somewhere. Well, yep. Yep.
But yeah.
Well, I'll just name one more thing that was kind of a mixed media thing in this movie. When they're introducing the different characters who are in the English as a second language class, there's this one girl who's like taken 11 English language classes or something, or who's studied 11 other languages, who's just kind of flighty, and like they introduce her by showing some video she made with her friends where she's like having a friend follow her with a video camera, like on campus with her college friends, and she's just talking. What else is good? I don't know. I really liked this movie. I think I probably liked it a little more than even Conduct Zero.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean
Conduct Zero might be the more like cohesive movie overall, and it sort of like juggles more Like, we keep saying that, you know, Korean movies juggle plot lines and moods and tones and stuff, but Please Teach doesn't have as many, like, and it doesn't have as many to juggle as Zero and Conduct did, but I don't know, Please Teach was just kind of more fun. I really liked the two main characters, Elvis and Candy.
Yeah. It, I mean, that's kind of the thing, is that, because his character is not exactly likable, it's interesting to see him. It's interesting to start liking him, even though he doesn't turn around until, halfway into the movie or whatever. Yeah.
Only after the sister thing comes up is he allowed to be vulnerable. You know, it was a really great joke in the movie. I mean, it's so simple. Like, you wouldn't laugh if it were in an American comedy, but it's funny in this. is when, like, the girl's had a few English classes, and she's like, talking to Koreans at her job, and she's like, "Thank you very much." And she drops something. "Oops, I'm sorry," just like over enunciating everything.
Oh, and then the kid, that was,
and
yeah.
And then a little like 4-year-old Korean girl says in a perfect little white girl voice, like, "Your English is terrible. You should speak in complete sentences."
Yeah, that was good, great.
Good old gag.
So, are you ready for Zardoz?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've heard about this movie for years, and how bad it is, but no one who ever, like, told me how bad it was even attempted to describe what it was like. They just said, like, you had to see it for yourself. And now that I have seen it, I got to admit, it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. And I was actually pretty entertained. It's not a good movie, but I don't think you can call it a complete disaster. It's just like, I think it does a lot of what it sets out to do. It's just that what it set out to do is so silly. Did you see that show Party Down?
I know what it is. I actually want to watch it. Yeah.
Well, like, one of the characters is played by Martin Starr from Freaks and Geeks. Bill, the skinny one with glasses, the skinny geek, and he plays this aspiring screenwriter on Party Down who's really into science fiction. But he always makes this distinction of what kind of science fiction he writes. He says, "I do hard sci-fi." And, like, no one ever, like, asks him to define it, but sometimes he has to define it as being, like, you know, not the Star Wars kind of sci-fi, not, like, the, you know, the simplistic stuff, but, like, the really heavy-duty, you know, like, set thousands of years in the future kind of sci-fi. And that's the kind of sci-fi that Zardoz is. And, like, I don't know if anyone's ever made a hard sci-fi movie that's ever been a commercial success, because, like, what, there's Dune? I mean, that was a big flop. And everybody, like, I mean, mainstream audiences don't, I mean, quality of the movie aside, like, it's asking a lot of audiences, most of whom aren't, like, even casual science fiction fans, like, to get into a story where, like, just as an opening premise, you're so far in the future that
it doesn't matter. Yeah.
That everything is unrecognizable, and, like, you know, social classes are completely different, and sex and gender is different, and just, like, everything's different, and so, like, as a result of everything being different, like, you don't know what people are talking about most of the time, unless you like pay attention or unless you've read the book or something. And I did read a quote from Borman saying that he probably should have done Zardoz as a book. And actually, there was a Zardoz book which came out with the movie, much like Arthur C. Clarke wrote 2001 to coincide with the movie. John Borman got some science fiction writer to co-author a Zardoz tie-in book. But that's kind of what Zardoz is. It's people referring to using all kinds of, like, terminology that you probably, like, can't even follow until you've seen the movie twice. And, like, okay, Zardoz has a prologue with a floating head of one of the characters, like, delivering exposition. And supposedly they added this to try to, like, bring people up to speed a little bit right when the movie starts. But it doesn't bring you up to speed on anything. All that happens is, like, this guy, this floating head shows up and he says, "I'm Arthur Frayn, and I'm Zardoz. I've lived for hundreds of years. I want to die, but I can't." And, like, as far as stuff that's actually going to relate to the plot later, like, that's it. Because, like, what he says afterwards is just all this, it's like this weird monologue about how, like, you know, the characters you are about to see are made up, and, you know, and I'm made up too, and, you know, who made you up, dear audience? Is God in show business? And he even says, like, I am the puppet master and stuff, and it's like it's totally like straight out of Bela Lugosi in the beginning of Glenn or Glenda, talking about being the puppet master and pulling the strings. It's like exactly the same.
Yeah, and Borman and it's said like, that it was a mistake in hindsight. As more,
yeah,
of a...
I mean, but it's also like, you know, I mean, like, why bother? I mean, all that you're doing with that prologue is like letting people know that this is the kind of movie that's willing to open with a floating head asking you who created you.
Yeah, and now
it kind of does let you know what you're in for in a way. It just doesn't clear up the plot very much.
When we talked about this,
yeah.
I said you don't even know what Zardoz is, and Zardoz
right.
is the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah,
Zardoz and I thought that actually mattered back when I told you that because I hadn't seen the movie.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I was going off of what people had told me, and they were like, it's Wizard of Oz. And so, for whatever reason, I sort of assumed that Zardoz was going to be, like, a quest movie where
yeah.
Sean Connery is trying to find the secret of Zardoz, and it really turns
that's
out...
Fun. That's
that
funny.
A book.
I...
Yeah.
I knew next to nothing about this movie, but that's also what I assumed about it. I assumed that the whole movie, because, you know, I'd seen the image of, you know, Sean Connery in this weird outfit that he's got, which has been used, you know, like as a punchline. And I saw it and I heard the title Zardoz, and I heard something about, you know, a giant floating stone head that's worshipped on whatever planet this is taking place on. I don't even know if it was Earth. So I thought the same thing too. Yeah. And for the first 10 minutes, it is that movie. But then for the next 110, it isn't. Which is disappointing because in a lot of ways, the first 10 minutes are the best.
And, yeah, I mean, and it turns out that no, what it's actually going to be is it's this future society where...
Like Logan's Run.
Yeah, and but I mean, Borman takes the time to go through everything with it, and so it's just I can't actually remember Excalibur. I know I've seen it twice, and I don't remember it at all.
Wow.
And okay. I think Zardoz is a lot like Excalibur in some ways, like where people are like, "Don't you remember in Excalibur when you know he got the sword?" And I'm like, "No." No, I don't remember that at all. Like, I think I probably have more memory of Zardoz, but that just could be because it's fresher in my head. But, I mean, you know, you read synopses of Zardoz, and I'm like, that happened in that? Because there's, like, in the description of the events of the movie at Wikipedia, I think, there's all this agency, like, that Sean Connery plans all this stuff, and really what you have is you just it reminds me of something else, and I don't think it's another Borman movie, so I feel bad that I can't remember what it is, but I mean the end of the movie is basically what 25 minutes of really strange, I guess they'd be action scenes, you know, everybody getting mowed down at one
yeah.
point, and then before
well,
that there's
yeah.
the fight there's, scene and
well yeah there's I mean There's like, you know, I think people would be a lot easier on this movie if about a half an hour were cut out. And you could easily take that half an hour out of these, like, quasi-psychedelic sequences where stuff is happening basically on a psychic level between people. And Borman's way of showing that visually is usually just to use a lot of slow motion and like, really cheap effects, like, projecting. Like, there's a scene where Sean Connery, like, mind melds with all the women in this.
Oh yeah, it looks like Flash Gordon. Yeah,
and the way that the minds meld with them is just like they're all in a big black void, and they're all talking over each other, just like stating, you know, information that's being put into Sean Connery's head. And like the way that it's visually represented is just like they project slides of that information over Sean Connery's face and stuff. And all and this and what you're talking about in the last 25 minutes, like. Probably the stupidest part of the movie. I mean, just from a plot perspective, is that like towards the end of the movie, you find out that this, you know, utopian dystopian society of immortals that Sean Connery bumbles into, only not. It's run by like a computer called the Tabernacle, but the computer isn't like, it's not a real computer. It's like a psychic computer, or it exists out of energy or something. It's really vague, and like Connery like finds it, like the people can talk to this computer like on little devices wherever they are in this society, but like Connery gets into this thing where he's like talking to it through some ring device, and he's looking at a crystal. And he's talking to the Tabernacle, and like somehow he tricks the Tabernacle into admitting that like it's life force is inside this crystal that he just happens to be looking at. And I'm like, what? And then all of a sudden, like, Sean Connery is doing psychic battle with the Tabernacle, and it's even like cheesier than the mind meld scene from earlier, because the way he does battle with it is by like they just like put him in some carnival funhouse of mirrors and had him run around in slow motion. And the way he, I don't even know how he defeats it. Like the way he defeats it is like he shoots at his own image in a mirror, and then the bullet hole in the mirror bleeds, and thus he beat the computer. It's really vague and stupid, and there's like one more sequence like that just goes on like forever, and they could have cut about a half an hour of all that stuff out, and I think people would be a lot easier on this movie if it didn't have those scenes in them.
I think Borman assumed he was going to be able to get away with a lot because of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, 2001, you know, they had the whole end sequence, what, 20 minutes of close-ups?
Yeah.
I think that Borman was like, well, I'm not just doing that. I'm going to do this, this, and this, and oh, it's, you know, we're doing this, and we're going to be able to get away with it.
Yeah, but like, the three things that he comes up with are just cheesy.
Exactly.
Like the 2001 thing is what it is, but it's also like a great looking optical special effect. Like the effects in Zardoz are like really Planet of the Apes, Logan's Run territory.
Yeah, I mean it's like, you know, an episode of the original series of Star Trek, you know.
Very pre-Star Wars special effects.
And
for a science fiction movie, this movie practically defines pre-Star Wars sci-fi movies.
I think some of the problem with that is Borman's just not a guy who, because I mean, some of it does look really good. Some of it does look really
well, like
good.
Like the stone head looks like, you'd think that would be one of the most laughable things in the movie, the floating stone head of Zardoz.
And
but
instead, it's totally fine.
Yeah, it's one of the better special effects.
And I think that's because, they shot it in, hold on. I was very interested where they shot it because,
oh, they shot it in, like, Ireland.
Yeah. And I mean, it just, you know, the scenery, everything just looks great, and
I was really, yeah.
It's Jeffrey Unsworth shooting it, so I think that helped a lot, but yeah, it's like, then when they add this other stuff, it's sort of, What about the house, the manor with the tubes? I'm kind of like, you guys. I mean, it looks like it looks like an episode of the Avengers. You know, it's just
actually a lot of this movie looks like an episode of the Avengers. Yeah, you know, one of the more problematic aspects of it is like, okay, so the first 10 minutes, I mean, Jesus Christ, okay, like four minutes into this movie, the giant stone head of Zardoz is yelling about how the gun is good and the penis is evil. And like, you can just see people back in 1974 like walking out of the theater. Like less than 5 minutes into this thing,
especially since that has nothing to do with their subsequent movie.
Yeah, I know, it's really disappointing. Like the first 10 minutes are really, really awesome because, like, you know, there's the craziness of this giant stone head, but like, the giant stone head has these guys on horseback and guns, and oh, after talking about how the gun is good and the penis is evil, and and Zardoz's followers need to go around killing people to prevent, you know, humanity from spreading, it barfs up guns. It, like, spews out of its giant, ugly stone mouth a supply of rifles and ammunition and stuff. And that's awesome. But, like, in the first 10 minutes, it's like you see that and you kind of get it, you know. It's like, okay, whatever world this is taking place in, there's Zardoz the Stonehead and his followers. And then the next scene after the credits is Connery stowing away inside the stone head, and it's really like mysterious and stuff, and like, you know, you get it's all silent, but you just, you know, you understand perfectly, like, this one of these guys stowed away inside the stone head to find out what was up. And then this guy shows up, who's the guy from the opening floating head thing, and like, Sean Connery shoots him right away, and at first you think, like, it's because, you know, he's just some dumb savage. And, you know, the guy says, like, you know, what a waste. You know, I could have told you everything. And he, like, falls out of the mouth, except it looks really weird. Looks like he's being suspended on wires away, but then it turns out that he's not dead later, so I guess that was the reason. But then, like, the stone head lands back at its base, which is this, you know, utopian village of people who live forever. And oh, but then the thing that happens in the first 10 minutes, like right before that too, is he's looking through Sean Connery's like looking through the room of the guy who he apparently killed, and like finding the schematics drawings for the head of Zardoz and stuff. And like, it's totally obvious that he's completely, you know, that this is some kind of secret society that Connery wasn't supposed to be privy to, but he stowed away, and now he, you know, and now he's in. And but then, like, as soon as he gets captured, he just kind of sort of seems to, like, not really care that he, it's like you wonder if he ever had a purpose for escaping. And then at the end of the movie, it turns out that, you know, the guy who was behind Zardoz actually planned for Connery to rebel all along and eventually break into the village and you know, help solve, like, I'm explaining the plot to Zardoz here. A couple of members of the Society of Immortals, they don't want to be immortal anymore and they're fed up with it, so that's why, like, Connery was tricked into being brought in and studied and stuff so that he could eventually, like, lead a rebellion of sorts. What was my point? I guess the thing that's problematic is that the movie is, like, as silly as the movie is in those first 10 minutes with the, you know, Zardoz will speak to you now and all that stuff, like, I found those first 10 minutes incredibly gripping because of being in you're kind of in Connery's shoes. You have no, you know, he doesn't know what this world is. You don't know what it is. You know, you're maybe, you know, a little bit smarter than Connery's character at this point because you're watching a movie and he's in it. But it's really intriguing. And then the more that Borman, you know, goes into detail about this society of immortals for the rest of the movie, like, the less interesting it is. And it's really not interesting. I mean, but, like, actually, he doesn't even, like, is it my did I miss something? Or does, like, Borman not even explain why this society of immortal geniuses are mostly women, and the few men that are left are gay? Like, it's a completely matriarchal society.
And let's not forget that Connery ends up with the chick who he has no chemistry with. I mean,
yeah, that's another thing entirely. But I mean, I found it annoying that this society is obviously matriarchal, but that's not explained. And the way that it's kind of like, you know, what really makes it hard sci-fi is that, like, this society has all these stupid names for the stupid things that they do. Like, you know, Connery is, you know, he's a lesser evolved human. He still has to sleep. He doesn't know how to do level 2 meditation. Which of course is what we do instead of sleeping.
That was my favorite part of the movie.
Oh, when
the
guy's like,
will not go to level 2 with you.
I won't go into level 2 meditation. I won't. And it's so dramatic, and, like, right, and he's surrounded by the other immortals who are all going into their psychic trance, and their psychic trance that's, like, you know, overpowering him is, like, them holding their arms out at length and, like, waving their arms up and down at him. And, like, there's a whole room of them doing it at this guy who won't conform. No! I won't go into meditation. I won't. It's hilarious.
At that point,
it's hilarious how seriously it takes itself while it's being so silly.
You're just kind of like, I love the ad that Beyond 2001, and I'm like, did Borman really think that?
that's like the connection to 2001, or like the one upsmanship is that, yeah, one of the taglines for the movie was Beyond 2001, Beyond 1984, Beyond Good, Beyond Evil, or something like that. But, like, they name check 2001 and 1984 to say like, you ain't seen nothing yet.
And what did he follow it up with? He followed it up with Exorcist 2, which he also recut.
Multiple times. Talk about two movies back to back destroying someone's reputation.
And well, then he did Excalibur, and I think, regardless of my complete lack of understanding of that film, it's pretty well respected. But yeah, I mean, and then he did small movies pretty much the rest. He did The Emerald Forest, which was a weird thing, but
yeah.
It's just a weird kind of...
You know what else is weird about this movie is that, like, there's kind of nothing in his filmography, like, before or after this, that would indicate that he's seriously into the science fiction genre.
Yeah, and I mean, this is not, yeah, like you said, this is hard sci-fi. This is not this is something that you would see out of Russia. I mean, this is how serious.
this is the kind of if this weren't a movie, it would be a dime store sci-fi paperback from the 1970s that has been out of print since the 1970s, and which was written completely on drugs and which no one remembers.
And I think maybe as a book it could work, but I looked up the book and it apparently is only 130 pages.
Whoa.
So I don't take it seriously. Unfortunately,
wow.
That could just be wrong. That I just Googled it really quick, and that was what Amazon said.
Yeah.
So I would not take it seriously. But if this were some, you know, big tome of, I might take it seriously because it's just full of, and you wouldn't have the problems of the visualizing. I mean, that's some of the other problem is that, yes, it's a sci-fi movie, but Borman's. Imagine 2001, the end of 2001 took place entirely inside that hotel room that looks a lot like the hotel rooms would end up looking in The Shining, you would not necessarily equate that to the future. And that is kind of what happens here, is that Borman's future looks a lot like the Irish country homes.
Yeah. Oh, I remember what I was trying to say earlier. Okay. My big problem with this future world is that, there's a couple of flashback scenes where you see the people who Connery and his tribe of Zardoz worshippers are killing, and they are, dressed in 20th century clothing, and they're just kind of, I don't know, milling around helplessly in the bombed out the dilapidated remains of towns and stuff. So how far in the future is this exactly? It's not.
Well, it's a few hundred years because they've been alive.
Okay. It's a few hundred years, but if it's a few hundred years, why are the people
asking so many questions?
Why are the non-eternals, why do they look like they're still from the 20th century? And also, what do they do when they're not being hunted and raped by Sean Connery? Yeah, what do they do? It's not really clear.
Another problem would be... So the secret of Zardoz turns out to be not that it's the Wizard of Oz, unfortunately, but that
not literally the Wizard of Oz,
but that he's been running sort of eugenics experiments on these people.
Yeah,
and
Connery was selectively bred to be the one who would eventually infiltrate and destroy the Immortals society. Yeah,
he's the Wolverine of Zardoz. But anyway, it's not enough time to run a eugenics experiment. It's not. Yeah. It would take a lot longer to breed mutants than 30, 40 years or however long
And then making it even more implausible. I think shortly after that revelation, they say that Connery's genetic, tinkering has been so good that he's actually capable of being more intelligent.
Yeah, he's smarter than everybody there.
He's actually smarter. He's the smartest man in the world, and that's why subsequently they do a mind meld scene where they impart all their knowledge to him because he can take it.
And he can also knock up the women who have been barren for.
Oh right.
Yeah.
stay inside my aura.
Okay.
That's the thing. He kind of turns into Neo at the end. He can just wave at someone and blow them back. It's crazy.
Unfortunately, the Matrix movies weren't as well thought out as Zardoz, as it turns out. But I did. Yeah, there are nice things to say about Zardoz.
What you just said, the revelation about the Wizard of Oz, I like that, actually. I don't know how clever it is. It might be really stupid. I can't tell. I just like it. I like that they show Connery reading. Okay, first of all, it makes no sense that he can learn to read, where is he going to have the time amongst the raping and pillaging to read a whole library of books that was left over?
Like Tarzan.
Okay, well, but I really like that, he's shown reading some book that makes him freak out, and they don't tell you what it is right away, and then later on they do reveal it, and it's the Wizard of Oz, and you see his thumbs move over the whiz and of, and it spells Zardoz, and I don't know, that's just...
Now, here's my question.
It's amusing, put it that
way. Why, if that's where Zardoz comes from, is that Zardoz is the character's name? How did he do that too?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
The only reason Connery finds the Wizard of Oz book
is because the guy shows it to him.
Yeah, the guy leaves it for him to find. Yeah. And figure it out on his own. It really doesn't make sense how he knew that Connery was going to attempt to kill him. Oh, wait a minute, except that he's immortal, so I guess when Connery shoots him, it doesn't matter. He can just fall and whatever, the tabernacle.
How did he get back? Is that ever explained how he got back?
I don't know, maybe the tabernacle just grew him back. Oh, wait, no, because he's missing for a while.
Yeah. And then he has that friend.
Oh, well, there's a character named Friend. I mean, we haven't been
talking...
His
character, his friend is his friend.
We haven't been talking about Friend, but he's a big part. He's like the big part of the movie.
Yeah.
He's kind of like an Eric Idle looking guy, and his job is basically to like be bemused by Connery and give him some exposition about their society. Oh, another stupid aspect of their stupid future society is that because they're immortal, the way that you're punished is that they age you. So it's kind of like Logan's Run would rip off a few years later almost. You know, the idea of eternal youth, but at what price? Anyway, so like when they age people enough, they go, you know, they go into senility, and like all the really aged, senile people, they're called renegades, and they have to live in some, I would call it a colony, except like apparently it's just like a house that's just, you know, nearby where the regular Eternals live, which isn't the best idea.
Does that remind you of anything? I'm trying to think of what that reminds me of, because that did remind me of something that they kept everybody in a...
Oh, well, there's also...
In a greenhouse, basically. I mean...
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing that reminded me of it more... Actually, I'm reminded of something else now that I don't know what it is, but the other subsect of the Eternal Society are the apathetics who are like so blissed out by, you know, having all of their needs taken care of that they just they've kind of lapsed into catatonia.
But Connery can bring them out of that because he's a real man.
Yeah, and they're like, I don't know. I guess they're all kept in a barn or something.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of.
That's the thing. Like you were saying, the Eternals like live in some Irish village somewhere where they were filming. So like, yeah, they're the undesirables of their futuristic society are all in a barn.
So, I mean,
because that's what was at the location.
In some ways, it kind of reminds me of did you ever see the movie version of what book is it? Oh, one second. The Vonnegut, where Valerie Perrine's in it.
Breakfast of Champions?
No,
Mother Night, Slaughterhouse 5.
Slaughterhouse 5. And did you ever see the movie?
No.
Okay, it's really bad special effects, like the future, you know, space with Montana Wild Hack is like really bad backdrop. Looks like it's something out of. So Zardoz kind of reminds me of what if Kurt Vonnegut really wrote stuff to be visualized like that, and then but he wrote Zardoz too, like yeah. It just seems like a really terrible idea that he'd never admitted to, like it'd be like a drawer novel where everybody lives in a greenhouse or a barn or they get the big house, like, because I mean that's really what it is. At some point in this movie you have the shot where Sean Connery's running from everybody and you realize there are only like, you know, 40 people in the entire future,
right?
And there are 40 people in the future, 6 of Connery's buddies who wear Zardoz masks, whoever they kill, and that's about it. And I mean it's like, what about the rest of the planet? Because there's a line in it about how they go to space,
well,
but, you know, that was boring, so they came back.
I thought maybe, the reason I was, well, what I was thinking about when I was watching it and wondering, like, you know, why are the people dressed, like, in the 20th century and stuff, I thought perhaps, like, the movie was meant to take place in England, which would be an island and isolated, and like, that might, maybe, like, England... Or maybe like Ireland is where the Eternals are, but England is where the Zardoz tribe is, and that's why they have to take the Stonehead over there, and that might explain the isolation and stuff. But really, it's just like, you know, create your own contrived explanation.
It bugs me in the same way Planet of the Apes bugs me, in that it's not the Planet of the Apes. It's one place. You know, in the entire Planet of the Apes series, we don't know what the hell happened on the other side of the planet. We only know what happens in around New York. You've got one settlement of apes. One settlement. It's not a Planet of the Apes. It's City of the Apes. But anyway.
I don't know if you've ever seen Super Mario Brothers, the movie, but there's the plot of Super Mario Brothers, the movie, is more coherent than Zardoz. It may not surprise you to know, but basically, like, there's an alternate reality version of New York, and it's, you know, it's run by people who evolved from dinosaurs, and that's who Dennis Hopper's bad guy King Koopa is. And there's a shot where he's in his lair and he's like looking, he's got a globe of this world that they live on, and the globe is like literally a few buildings sticking up from where they are, and then the entire rest of the globe is a desert. And so like he spins the globe, and just that one blotch of civilization is just like spinning on a big what's basically the Earth. And they're letting you know, like, yeah, don't even think about the rest of the planet. It's all desert. This is the only this is the only civilization there is. There should have been a scene like that in Planet of the Apes, except that they're too primitive for that. And speaking of Planet of the Apes, I wanted to mention how much this movie reminded me of it. I mean, you got Connery mostly naked, just like Charlton Heston running around. But then also, like, at the end of the movie where they're, like, chasing Heston around a lot, they're all chasing him on horses. And then it's really, like, Planet of the Apes. They're trying to throw nets on him and stuff. It's straight out of Planet of the Apes.
And I think that's probably...
Planet of the Apes is probably, like, the biggest influence on this movie.
Yeah.
As far as other science fiction movies. Definitely more than 2001.
Or especially 1984. I don't even know why that would be...
Yeah.
In the tag. Well, we haven't even gotten to the ending, which is Connery and Charlotte Rampling.
Yeah.
Who have no chemistry.
Let's go through it though. Let's get all the way to the end.
Okay.
Because I want to talk about when everybody dies. A friend was the one who wouldn't go into level 2 meditation. So as punishment, they age him. Except apparently they only age half of his face. So, like, half of his face is an old age makeup and the other half isn't, and it's really weird. But he gets consigned to, you know, the area where they keep all the other people who are forcibly aged and made senile,
like,
and stuff.
This is, like, 16 people and they dance a lot. It's that scene from... The Shining. But anyway, continue.
After Connery runs around in the funhouse mirror and defeats the tabernacle and becomes the one, he's like walking around and he liberates the undesirables of the society. He liberates the catatonics. Like, they all touch him and their life is restored. And he liberates the renegades, who are all senile old people, and they start to like, you know, run throughout the rest of the Eternal Society, and he lets his Zardoz tribe into the Eternals villa, and I'm not sure how that happened, because the only way that he got there was, you know, by stowing away and flying Zardoz's head, so how did they know where to follow him to? In the climax, I don't know, it has a kind of poetry to it. Like, he definitely does, like, Borman definitely gets the irony that he was going for, because, like, the whole reason that Friend and the guy who turns out to be Zardoz, you know, like, their big plan was, like, they want to die. Like, they're sick of being immortal. The whole plan, Connery in there, was, like, to kill them, basically. They don't want to go on living. So, like, that's also happening to a ton of other people in society. They're just kind of, like, the Zardoz tribe is on horseback running through and just shooting people, and they're all really happy to get shot. And And that's pretty crazy. And as that's happening, yeah, Connery kind of like disinterestedly leaves, and he leaves with the leader of the lead matriarch of the Eternals, who hated him and wanted him like put to death almost like right at the start of the movie. But I guess she's just so grateful that that he brought her with him that that they decide to live the rest of their lives together in a cave. In one spot on a cave, actually. They just
That's a metaphor.
They find a nice bench and they settle down, and then as Beethoven music plays, we see a series of cross dissolves as they age and have a child who grows up sitting in between them until finally they are skeletons. And that's the last shot of the movie, is like they're two skeletons holding hands. It's silly.
What's crazy is that there are survivors of the Eternals or whatever the hell they're called. And the girl
The Zardoz tribe is still out there.
Well, the Zardoz tribe's still out there, and then that girl led those people through the forest, and they looked down on the house on fire, you know, the future as a house.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the thing is he, for whatever reason, the girl that he likes, or that likes him, runs off, leaving him. I think Charlotte Rampling was just impressed with him having his powers outside the Matrix when he was, you know, pushing people back and then reversing time and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That was actually a pretty effective sequence when time was reversing and things were flying back together. I mean, you know, practical, you know, things like that. I mean, it does look good. I mean, it's like, it's cool.
It's true. It's true. It's a low tech effect that it's just intrinsically cool.
Yeah.
Zardoz, though.
In some ways, it also reminds me of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, though, I'm sure.
the Irish landscape definitely looks a lot like the Scottish landscape that Monty Python was filmed in.
I mean, it's...
Plus, you got all these guys on horseback chanting nonsensical things.
I never heard that it was as bad as I guess you had. I just heard that it was kind of a John Bourne movie. And I mean, that's kind of the thing is, I mean, Deliverance is nothing
the guy who never directed another good movie.
No, see, I've heard The General's good. I haven't seen it. That was one his comeback movie. And I really like The Tailor of Panama. But I mean, it's just a movie. It's not, you know, some epic. I mean, this is the 70s, you know, people were given, and that's kind of the thing is, you know, that people, it's not like, you know,
it's
only
really...
Christopher Nolan got to make whatever movie he wanted, or only James Cameron doesn't even get to make whatever movie he wants. Everybody was able to make whatever movie they wanted as long as they had some sign of success. I mean, you know, Lucas was able to get money for American Graffiti based on THX 1138, you know, like...
It's just like, you're just watching Zardoz and you're thinking, like, well, again, like, about 4 minutes in, there's a giant stone head talking about the gun is good and the penis is bad. And he's barfing up guns, and you're just thinking, like, how did, like, no one, like... How could anyone have thought this was commercial?
Well, I mean, the other thing is, how could neither of us have any idea what the hell the movie was about? I mean,
I don't know. I think we've got it pretty good.
Well, no, we do now, but beforehand, I mean, if anybody had seen this and talked to me about it, I would expect to have a T-shirt that says, "I will not go to level two with you. I will not go to level two."
I won't.
I mean, it's a Dr.
It was
Zeus
Callahan. I watched the trailer on YouTube, and it's a lot like the Exorcist 2 trailer. It's just like they just show you. There's just so much like stupid imagery that all they can, and such an incomprehensible plot that all they can do is show you a bunch of snippets from all the crazy imagery for like 2 minutes and then say, you know, prepare to have your mind blown.
Well,
if you come see this movie.
I was able to find some of the CBS Fox home video opening clips on YouTube, but not the one for their science fiction box set, which this was a part of on sell through VHS. And that's how I'd always seen it. It was in that clips of it in that, and it was I think it was Alien, it was this, it was Cocoon, and I don't know what else. And I know that they clipped together Zardoz and the spaceship from Cocoon, and so, you know, I was never sure if maybe, you know, it was like Dark City or something where they're on. So
I'm guessing Planet of the Apes was in that box set.
It actually wasn't, because Planet of the Apes would have had its own set.
Right.
And they had Back to Action and Back to... And you can find the clip for, like, Back to Action 2. And what pisses me off is you know somebody's sitting out there with some VHS tape with this on it and could put it on YouTube for me, but, you know, it's inaccessible information at this point.
Yeah. How much time do we have left?
I think we're probably over because of Zardoz.
Yeah, I think so too. But let me. Okay, here's my concluding thought on Zardoz. I enjoyed it because as ill-conceived as it all was, it was at least going for something. Like, it definitely had ambition. It was definitely trying to tell a hard sci-fi story. You know, we kind of, it's like, you know, the reason Star Wars was the death of all that was because, like, Star Wars also has a ton of, like, terminology that needs to be explained to you. Like, you know, you need to be shown what a hut is, and you need to be explained what the Force is, and you need to be, you know, there's, like, political machinations about the Empire and stuff. And there's all that stuff, but, like, Star Wars kind of put it all into the mold of being, you know, like a story of good and evil kings and queens and good and evil princes and princesses. Whereas something like Zardoz is attempting to be richly satirical, I believe, as the floating head put it in the opening. And I guess that's why I enjoyed it, because no matter how silly it got, I always knew that there was some, you know, there was some well-intentioned thought behind the silliness. And I liked it more than, let's say, Logan's Run, which is also an allegorical science fiction movie about the price of eternal youth, but it's not nearly as outlandish. And thus, it's not nearly as ambitious. So, Zardoz, I'll give it a pass. It's a bad movie, but I'll give it a pass.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah. When was the last time you saw it? Because you kept saying, like, you had to work yourself up, like, mentally for this.
For Zardoz? I've never seen it.
Oh. Wow, that's weird. We've had this whole discussion assuming that you did.
Oh, goodness, no. If I'd seen Zardoz, I'm serious, I probably would have had a shirt that said, "I will not go to level 2 with you," with a big pointy finger pointing at somebody saying, "I will not go to level." I mean, I think Zardoz should be remade as a, you know, one man show, something. Like, I mean, it's crazy, and there is a lot of, I don't know. I was disappointed to see that the novel is apparently not some ambitious work too, because I think if you were to remove some of the practical silliness of it, the giant balloons on top of the Irish castle, for instance, you'd be able to take it a little bit more seriously. Like Sean Connery being chased around by people who wish to do him harm. If that took place not in a barn, for example.
Yeah.
I think you'd be able to take it more seriously because it feels like a BBC TV special from the 70s, you know, like.
Yeah. I guess the other thing that made it very Planet of the Apes to me is that this futuristic society regards him as a primitive, the way that the apes and Planet of the Apes are going on about how Charlton Heston is Heston was a mutant in that, or they thought he was a mutant.
But weren't there actual, that was the second one where there were actual mutants.
Sean Connery actually is a mutant. Yeah, Zardoz is a little more beneath the Planet of the Apes.
What the hell's the sun going to do?
Are you talking about beneath the Planet of the Apes or
Zardoz? I mean, beneath the Planet of the Apes ends with the world being destroyed, which is incredible. But
yeah.
In Zardoz, the movie ends with him and Charlotte Rampling having a son. Why in God's name would they have had a son?
I thought you meant like in the sky because of the underground dwellers.
No.
What is their son going to do? Yeah, what the hell?
Like, how's he going to feed himself? The immortals, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, we really should have just ended on,
actually,
the flaming wreck.
I think it's time for Zardoz 2 Legacy.
In
3D. You can CGI in a young Sean Connery. Come on.
You can have Sean Connery act opposite himself, his young self.
It'd be perfect. Because that's all Zardoz needed was some CG costumes.
He needed that head. Head needed to be CG.
Oh, dude, the head in CG. Oh, can you even imagine? I mean...
No, I can't.
Yeah, there you go.
Anyways.
So that was Zardoz.
If you don't...
But go see it.
I think so too.
Yeah, it's on Netflix right now. But yeah, no, go see it. I mean,
it's streaming on Netflix.
Basically, once
watch
you get
right now.
You know, after the first say 10 minutes, you've got the painful period where there's lots of rear projection of Sean Connery's thoughts in the introduction. But once you're through that, then it gets a lot more amusing.
Yeah. And if you don't feel like slogging through the whole thing, please at least watch the first 10 minutes, the best part.
Yeah.
Hear the voice of Zardoz speaking to his followers. You'll never forget it.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Nice. Well, I can actually tie Zardoz to our next episode, believe it or not.
Go for it.
Our next episode is a special, and it's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original from the 70s. Oh, same year as Zardoz, 74. That's not the connection, though. But the original Tobe Hooper Chainsaw, which you have not seen, and which is my favorite horror movie, so it'll be fun to talk about. And we're going to watch one of the bad sequels for our bad movie. And the bad sequel we're watching was there were two of them made in the 90s. There was Leatherface: The Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, which came out in 90, and there was The Return of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which was filmed and screened in 94 but then wasn't released for another 3 years because it stars both Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey, and in the interim Jerry Maguire came out and they both really didn't want to be in a chainsaw movie after that, but the movie did come out and it was called Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Next Generation. So that's the bad one we're going to. And the connection to Zardoz is actually a connection to Borman, and it's not to Chainsaw 4. It's to Chainsaw 3, which we were considering doing as the bad one. But the connection to Chainsaw 3 is that the trailer for Chainsaw 3 is a parody of the trailer for Excalibur, believe it or not. And this is insane. This would have been like a 9-year-old parody when they did this. But I guess Michael DeLuca just really loved this idea. It's like a big fat guy standing in front of the water, and the narrator is talking about some legends are eternal and will never be forgotten. And then I guess in the Excalibur trailer, like the Lady of the Lake threw the Excalibur sword up through the water and it swung through the air in slow motion, and then King Arthur grabs it or something. The chainsaw trailer is it's a chainsaw, and Leatherface grabs it, and like a freaking bolt of lightning strikes it, and then he spins around, and oh, it's Leatherface, and yeah, it's a parody of the Excalibur trailer. It's just the oddest thing, especially since they were like trying to reestablish the series, and like New Line was trying to make it into their new horror franchise, aside from the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. So it's just absurd, but there it is, the John Borman Texas Chainsaw connection. So yeah, our next episode will be the Texas Chainsaw special with the original and the next generation. And I'm looking forward to it. All right. It's going to be good.
Yeah.
So
I'm scared.
Yeah, you should be scared. Because the original is scary and part four is just horrendous. For an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.